Good afternoon. Hope you all had an enjoyable lunch. You're here this afternoon and in this session to hear about the interaction of capital across banking and insurance. So I hope that's what you have come to listen to. Prepared by Elaine Collins and Lucy Simpson. Elaine joined Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants in 2006 as head of the firm's general insurance actuarial practice. She has more than 15 years of general insurance experience and is co-author of the J.P. Morgan Deloitte General Insurance Survey, a survey of historical and forecast results for the general insurance industry. Elaine has expertise in providing and leading a wide variety of general insurance advice, including continually holding the appointed actuary position in Australia since 2001 and acting as reviewing actuary for a number of authorised insurers. She has experience in undertaking valuations and capital requirements for a varied class of business, including lenders' mortgage insurance. Elaine is a current member of the General Insurance Practice Committee and the Institute of Actuaries Australia. She has written a number of papers and had particular involvement in the drafting of professional standards applicable to general insurance. Lucy Simpson. Lucy has a maths and stats background and over 17 years of general insurance experience, most of it working with actuaries. She started her career working for a reinsurance company in London before moving into a run-off service work, including a period at Equitas. She joined Deloitte in London in 2001 and transferred to here in Sydney in 2005. As well as specialising in work within the run-off and reinsurance markets, Lucy has experience of providing a wider range of services to insurance clients, including valuation, internal audit, and LMI projects. She also works for the banking sector and particularly the mortgage market. Without further ado, can I pass you over to Lucy?
Thank you, Paul, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our session on the interaction of capital across banking and insurance. I'm just going to start off with a quick roadmap of where we're going this afternoon. I'm going to start off with a quick introduction. I'm then going to move on to talk about capital within banks, and particularly around residential mortgage exposures, both from the perspective of the bank itself and its exposures, and also how it uses lenders' mortgage insurance. I'm then going to hand over to Elaine, who will talk about the impact of the global financial crisis on the mortgage sector and capital for general insurers. We'll then summarise, and we will aim to leave a bit of time at the end for anyone that has any questions or comments on the presentation. So I kick off with an introduction here. This presentation is building on some of the work that we've done over the last 6 months or so around the capital requirements for banks and general insurers. And in the current environment, we're sort of building on our thinking all the time. So what we're going to do today is really our latest thoughts in this area. Now, the implementation of the Basel II capital framework is going to have widespread implications for both the banks and lenders' mortgage insurers. As you've probably noticed today, there have been several references through both the plenary and some of the other concurrent sessions around the implementation of Basel II and what its impact is. So it obviously seems to be something that's quite topical at the moment. So we're going to consider the impact of the transition from Basel I to Basel II from the perspective of banks that are using both the standardised and the advanced approaches to calculating capital requirements. We're also going to consider banks that use captive lenders' mortgage insurers and those that source their lenders' mortgage insurance elsewhere in the market. Now, for banks with retail exposures, they're actually split into three different categories within the Basel II Accord. We're concentrating on residential mortgage exposures here. We do acknowledge that the other two types of exposure, qualifying revolving exposures, which generally tends to include credit card portfolios, and other retail exposures, which picks up personal loans and other similar types of lending, there's probably a similar interaction with capital there in light of the credit, consumer credit insurance as well. But as I said, we're going to focus on the mortgage portfolios. In the last 12 months, we've experienced a deteriorating global credit environment, which has culminated in the severe global downturn that we've seen in the last few months. There have been considerable impacts on a wide range of financial institutions, and this has led to significant value being attached to the efficient use of capital, which is what we're really focusing on today. Let's start off just a little bit of background on the Basel Accord for anyone who's not familiar with it. The Basel Committee is an international standard setter for banking supervision. It consists of representatives of the central banks and bank supervisory authorities of the 11 G10 countries and also Luxembourg and Spain. And while the committee has no formal international authority and its pronouncements have no legal force, it does expect that individual member countries will take steps to implement its guidelines and recommendations. So the implementation of Basel II in Australia, which officially began during 2008, is going to significantly change the way in which banks are required to calculate their capital. And these changes are actually likely to have a significant impact on the amount of capital that banks are required to hold. Now, again, just making reference to some of the other presentations we've listened to today, we have heard thoughts that this might actually reduce the overall capital within the banking system. We believe that the impact is going to be most noticeable for those banks who actually have a captive lender's mortgage insurance. And the reason for this is that under Basel I, capital concessions for lenders' mortgage insurance actually allows banks with captive LMIs to obtain significant regulatory ADI capital savings. After the transition to Basel II, these concessions are going to be removed for the banks, the banks who adopt the advanced internal ratings-based approach. Now, I've mentioned there the advanced internal ratings-based approach. You'll see from the slide that there are actually three different approaches. So at the moment, we're just talking about the third of those. The other two approaches are the standardised and the foundation IRB. Foundation IRB is only actually used within commercial lending. So for the purposes of discussing mortgage portfolios, that approach is not relevant. In Australia, the big four banks and the larger regional banks are actually implementing the advanced IRB approach to calculating their capital requirements, with other banks implementing the foundation approach. Implementing the standardised approach, the other banks. The standardised approach is the most simple. It uses risk-weighted assets and credit conversion factors, which are prescribed by APRA. And although it's been reworked, it's not too much of a shift from the Basel I position. However, the advanced internal ratings-based approach actually allows banks to calculate the inputs into their capital calculation. And those inputs are mainly the probability of default, PD, the exposure at default, EAD, and the loss given default, LGD. The risk-weighted asset calculation for the three different types of exposures are actually are very different, but the definitions of PD, EAD, and LGD are very similar. So thinking about these inputs from the perspective of a mortgage portfolio, as a mortgage account ages, the PD for an individual customer segment is broadly expected to increase over time until it reaches a peak and then start to decrease. Now, the point in time at which this peak occurs can vary significantly for different portfolios and under different economic environments. In general, the LGD is expected to decrease with time. This is because property values tend to increase over time, capital is repaid on loans, and consequently loan-to-value ratios decrease. However, if an economic shock occurs, perhaps the sort of situations we're dealing with at the moment, property and land prices can decrease, leading to increases in loan-to-value ratios and therefore higher LGDs. Now, this becomes a significant problem for a lender if a crash in the property market coincides with a period where a large proportion of the portfolio has a high probability of default. So the next slide just illustrates the area that we're talking about. As you can see, there are three pillars under the Basel II Accord. We're looking at Pillar 1, which is around the minimum capital requirements, and we're looking at credit risk in the banking book, particularly retail, and the standardised approach and the IRB approach. So as you can see, by no stretch of the imagination are we covering the whole of Basel II in this presentation. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about residential mortgage exposures. And as I mentioned earlier, due to the significant capital concessions that a bank with a captive LMI can get under Basel I, a number of banks obviously created captives in order to get this advantage. As well as actually providing protection to the mortgage portfolio and decreasing capital requirements, these captives also created an attractive revenue stream for the banks. But as we've said, after the transition to Basel II, the LMI concessions will be reduced or removed for the advanced IRB banks, and therefore capital efficiency is going to be reduced in comparison to the old Basel I regime. For those banks who don't have the advanced IRB accreditation and are using the standardised approach, some LMI capital concessions will remain under Basel II. For those adopting the advanced IRB approach, there is also expected to be a transition period, probably of at least 2 years. That may be extended at APRA's discretion, and we expect that the events in the recent, we expect that recent global financial events may actually impact on APRA's decision regarding the timing of the full implementation of Basel II. Now, the important thing with the transition period is that APRA have actually imposed a floor on the capital reduction that can occur between Basel I and Basel II calculations, and that floor is 90%. So if calculating your capital under Basel II results in a number that is less than 90% of your old Basel I calculation, then there is a floor on the capital of 90% of your Basel I number. Now, the introduction of the Basel regime is really intended to result in the banks getting a much better understanding of how their risk profile of their risk profiles, and it's really all linked to risk management. And there have been a lot of presentations today already on risk management as well. Obviously, LMI is just one of the methods that a bank can use to actually protect itself and to mitigate against risk. And I think we need to recognise in the current environment that risk profiles are changing within the banks as well. So while Australia's never offered the ninja loans that we talked about in the plenary session this morning, they have offered 100% mortgages to some of their customers. And we're noticing that in the current environment, these loans are increasingly unavailable. A lot of banks have actually switched to not lending at above a 90% LVR. So this is leading to a very different risk profile for some of the banks as they change their lending criteria, as the loans are distributed differently over LVR bands, and as the loan and borrower characteristics change. Now, all these changes in the risk profile are actually leading to banks thinking about different ways in order to transfer risk. So as well as traditional lenders' mortgage insurance, there's also some alternative LMI products being developed in the market, and also some risk pricing mechanisms actually being used within the banks as an alternative to lenders' mortgage insurance. So the transition from Basel I to Basel II, for those banks that have a captive LMI, is making a lot of differences. Those who don't have a captive LMI don't necessarily have the same imperative to consider their options, but again, given that we're in an uncertain climate and that risk profiles are changing quite considerably, they're also beginning to look at the way in which they use their lender's mortgage insurance. So that just takes us on to a brief summary of lender's mortgage and the way that it works in Australia. Historically, the reasons for purchasing lender's mortgage insurance have been the risk transfer element, in that the transaction removes credit risk for residential loans from the lender to the mortgage insurer. As we've mentioned several times already, the capital leverage is a really important part of historically LMI being used. It also helps to introduce underwriting discipline. The mortgage insurer's underwriting processes can actually support the lender's own processes. And pricing strategy. Through using particularly external LMI, you can actually gain a lot of, a bank can actually gain a lot of market knowledge and insurance and experience through using an insurer. Got a bit of information here around the growth in the market. As you can see, it's grown in the last 10 years from about $39 million in gross written premium to over $1.1 million in 2008. We actually observed a small decrease in the gross written premium between December 2007 and June 2008. Now, that's only about $10 million, but it certainly seems to be the start of a reversing of a trend that we've seen over previous years. Unfortunately, at the moment, the latest figures we can get from APRA are the June 2008. So we're waiting for the December 2008 numbers to come out to see whether we're going to see that trend continue. The captive LMI market historically has grown faster than the specialist LMI market, although off a much smaller initial base. So captives, while they accounted for 10% of the market in 1997, 10 or 11 years later, they then accounted for 24%. So there's a lot of the market that's actually benefiting under Basel I from the capital arbitrage opportunities, which may not be there going forward. The next slide is just a quick illustration of how the market was divided as at June 2008. We're not expecting to see a significant difference in the way that the market is actually divided up in December 2008. Obviously, PMI will be Suncor on the next... QBE on the next set of figures. But what we are thinking we're going to see is actually some slowdown in the growth of the market, or possibly even a contraction of the market. So some of the characteristics of LMI. LMI is a very cyclical business, and we're actually here trying to look at the banking and the insurance together. So actually understanding the liabilities of a lender's mortgage insurance is closely linked to understanding the credit risk for a bank's mortgage portfolio. Several of the same factors are actually considered in evaluating the portfolios. So, for example, whereas under Basel II, the bank looks at default rates over a one-year time horizon, for the insurance liability valuation report, you would actually look at the default rates, but you'd look over a full time horizon to ultimate. And the same would be said for LGD as well. One of the very interesting things is that for an LMI claim to actually arise, you need a combination of circumstances to actually occur. First of all, a borrower must default on their loan, the lender must repossess that property, and the net sales proceeds, after allowing for expenses, must be less than the outstanding debt on that particular loan. So we see defaults influenced by a number of economic factors, which include interest rates, unemployment rates, the original loan-to-value ratio of the loans, and also how the LVR moves. And we also see individual borrower characteristics, some of the demographic factors around the people taking out the loans affect the PDs. Economic factors also affect the loss given default as well. But it's worth noting that an increase in default rates does not necessarily result in an increase in lenders' mortgage insurance claims. Lenders' mortgage insurance claims increase when defaults rise within a declining property market. So again, perhaps the type of economic environment that we're currently finding ourselves in. The combination of higher interest rates, increased unemployment and falling house prices causes above average LMI losses. If you're looking at an LMI portfolio and you're observing increased loss ratios, that can happen for one of two reasons as well. It may be as a result of the factors we've just talked about, which are high losses increasing from increasing defaults, or it may be due to increasing claim sizes, or it could occur as a result of low premiums as well, under market pressures with premiums being reduced. So now I'm going to hand over to Elaine, and she's going to run through the impact of the global financial crisis on some of these factors in a little bit more detail, as well as going on to discuss the consistency between the calculation of bank and general insurance capital.
Thank you, Lucy, and good afternoon, everyone. We've obviously heard a lot about the global financial crisis already this morning. But I'm going to go over it more with a specific application to lenders' mortgage insurance. The financial crisis of, we now say 2007 to 2009, but we don't actually know if 2009 is the right number at the end there, began in July 2007 when a loss of confidence by investors in the value of securitised mortgages in the USA resulted in a liquidity crisis. And that prompted a substantial injection of capital into the financial markets by the United States Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, and the European Central Bank. In September 2008, the crisis deepened as share markets worldwide declined dramatically and entered a period of high volatility, and a considerable number of banks, mortgage lenders, and insurance companies failed in the following weeks. The crisis in real estate, banking and credit in the United States had a global reach, affecting a wide range of financial and economic activities and institutions, including, we've just got a list here, the overall tightening of credit, liquidity problems, devaluation of assets underpinning insurance contracts, increased public debt finance, and devaluation of some currencies. Although the housing collapse in the USA is often cited as having caused the crisis, it was mentioned this morning too in support of this, the financial system was also vulnerable alongside that, and that's really because of the intricate and highly leveraged financial contracts and operations throughout the system, as well as monetary policy in the USA making the cost of credit negligible, therefore encouraging these very high levels of leverage. This global crisis and the widespread impacts of the mortgage downturn in the USA caused lenders' mortgage insurers in the US to fall substantially in value. This has meant that capital from the US LMI parents for Australian LMIs is now far less available. Other implications in Australia are that the banks again are dominating lending versus the non-banks, and as Lucy was previously mentioning, are only lending up to loan-to-value ratios of around 90%. This means that a lot of the loans will not need LMI in the traditional sense. So there could be one of two things: less LMI in the future, or more LMI in the future as lenders choose to remove mortgage risk from their portfolios, having now become much more risk aware. The Australian LMI market is not directly comparable to the US market, and certainly that has cushioned us from some of the impacts. Firstly, the originators of residential mortgages in Australia are subject to more regulatory controls than the lenders have been in the USA. This has led to an environment where the monitoring of the lending practices of loan originators is greater. For example, in the USA, mortgage loans have been granted to large numbers of individuals with impaired credit ratings. This type of lending is far less likely to have occurred in the Australian market. So in Australia, there are standard loans and low-doc loans, and very few credit-impaired loans, whereas in the US, around 9 or 10% of mortgages are subprime when they are originally underwritten. A subprime mortgage is a residential mortgage loan to a borrower who would not typically qualify for a loan from a traditional prime lender. Subprime loans include non-conforming loans and loans to borrowers with prior credit impairments, and these are the sorts of loans that have caused a number of problems. Low-doc residential loans are a small but increasing part of Australian lending. There's still not that much history on low-doc loans, whether they are going to be significantly greater risk than the prime loans, because they haven't been written for long enough to really know that yet. But the low-doc loans are usually available only to self-employed borrowers, but they do have to self-certify income. And in all cases, they have to provide evidence of at least 2 years of continuous business operation in Australia, for example, through a registered ABN. Such loans are primarily where the LVR is below 80%, and a good credit history is a key lending criteria for loan approvals. LMI premiums for the full life of the residential mortgage are paid upfront by the lender in Australia. In the US, premiums are paid by instalments in line with monthly mortgage payments over the life of the loan. Therefore, early settlement or termination or default in the US results in reduced levels of premium received, whereas in Australia, the premium would all be received up front, and this causes problems for the LMI entities. Another factor is that the restrictions on a borrower's credit history at loan application are generally much tighter in Australia than they have been in the USA. Capital for general insurers. There's an APRA-specified regulatory amount of capital that general insurers in Australia have to hold, and that's the minimum capital requirement, the MCR. There have been some changes that have been applicable to all general insurers, and those changes were applicable from 1 July 2008, so that's from about 9 months ago. Some of the changes that APRA introduced were doubling the capital factor for investments in listed equities from 8% to 16%, and doubling the factor to investments in unlisted equities and direct property from 10 to 20%. So those changes are actually applicable to all general insurers, not just LMIs. Additionally, the capital factors applied to reinsurance recoveries for non-APRA authorised insurers, reinsurers are between 1% and 4% higher than for reinsurance recoveries from APRA authorised insurers, and that's providing that the reinsurance recoverables are supported by collateral. Authorised LMIs in Australia must be monoline insurers. That's an APRA requirement. This particular licence cannot write any other lines of business. So when you do have a global conglomerate like QBE who do own a mortgage insurer, there has to be a separate licence writing only the mortgage business, and the other QBE licences can write the other lines of business. The most significant element of an LMI's regulatory capital requirement is the concentration risk capital charge, which is made up of the maximum event retention, that's that MER. So the MER is the key element for that really contains the capital requirement for an LMI. As a result of APRA's Project Panama in 2006, capital requirements for LMIs increased significantly. These new APRA-specified PDs and LGDs in the maximum event retention are intended to allow for a 1 in 250-year event, and it makes LMI a capital-intensive business. It's interesting to note that for other lines of general insurance business, APRA does not specify the probabilities that need to be used in the calculations of the 1 in 250-year event. APRA released a new discussion paper in Draft Prudential Standard, which is DPS 116, on September the 16th, 2008, with particular application to LMIs. The proposed changes to the Prudential Standard include variations to allow the allowable reinsurance calculation for XOL cover. Even after this proposed change, there's still some inconsistencies that can arise in the allocation of capital between the cedent and the reinsurer, and this is particularly with excess of loss reinsurance coverage. There's no proposed change from APRA on the capitalised premium requirement. The explanation around that is that it refers to the fact that the loan, APRA requires, if the loan is increased to allow for the LMI premium up front, that's called then a capitalised premium, and it affects into which PD band the loan falls. The loan might have fallen into a lower probability of default band, but then once the premium gets added to it, it falls into a higher band, and therefore the LMI insurer has to hold more capital. There have been observations in the mortgage industry that the LMI market capital was deemed sufficient before allowance for capitalised premiums was made. Now the LMI market capital is higher, despite there being no change in the true underlying risk profile, and there's no offset for it. APRA intends for the final GPS 116 to be released during the second quarter of 2009 and for it to take effect from 1 July 2009. Standard & Poor's analyses the capital adequacy for life insurers, property casualty insurers, health and reinsurance companies using their risk-based capital model. One of the elements considered by S&P in assigning or changing an LMI's credit rating is the composition of actual capital to the S&P capital adequacy requirement. I mean, certainly I'm sure all these capital models are now being looked at again and again, but the S&P themselves update their model on a regular basis. Their capital requirement is calculated, the last time we looked at it, for LMI insurers using a similar methodology to APRA, but S&P uses different loss assumptions. Insights drawn from the S&P model are evaluated by S&P in conjunction with more qualitative factors, including composition of a company's capital structure, asset quality, insurance liability adequacy, contingent assets and liabilities, the level of reinsurance dependency, and they then form a comprehensive opinion on the level of capitalisation. The model then seeks to determine the amount of capital that's necessary to cover losses at varying confidence levels, from disparate risks in excess of insurance liabilities over the expected life of a company's insurance portfolio. In the model, each risk variable is stressed using confidence levels, and it's observed over a 5-year defaults, and although the impact is measured over 5 years, the volatility used to create the stress scenarios is based on the potential movements in a 1-year period. The S&P model seeks to capture the present value of expected economic losses experienced over an annual period to a degree of certainty that's consistent with an LMI's credit rating. We have noticed instances where S&P capital requirements can be in excess of the maximum potential losses for an LMI insurer. LMI going forward. We're now going to consider the implications of the changing capital regime and the new risk transfer methods for the future of LMIs. Historically, Lucy's previously been over the primary reasons to purchase mortgage insurance, and they are risk transfer, capital leverage, Underwriting discipline. Underwriting discipline we haven't really gone over. That's where the mortgage insurer's underwriting processes support the lender's own processes and are at arm's length to customer relationships. And there's some confidence can be gained from the fact that the underwriting is occurring sort of over two parties. And pricing strategy is another important piece of information. The market knowledge and the experience that the insurer can share with the lender. The shape of the LMI market is ripe for change. The size and circumstances of the loan originator has determined which of these criteria drives the requirements for LMI. The ongoing lending criteria. In the current economic environment, banks are tightening lending criteria, particularly for high LVR loans. Some banks, as we've said before, are only offering loans up to 90% LVR, which diminishes the need for LMI, which is traditionally applied to the high LVR loans. Risk transfer. The problem with not implementing LMI includes no risk transfer to reliable third parties, something which organisations are acutely aware is vitally important in these times of financial uncertainty. And the third is capital leverage. Following the implementation of Basel II, banks are reviewing the use of captive LMIs as a method of insuring these loans, because if the capital concessions for LMI are reduced or eliminated, there's less advantage in placing LMI with captive insurers, because there's no true risk transfer in these circumstances. It's just another entity within the same group. We're now going to explore the issues of consistency between the regulatory and rating agency capital calculations across LMIs, lenders, mortgage reinsurers, and banks. These three standards listed on the slide cover credit risk, but there are inconsistencies between GPS 116, which is capital adequacy, because the concentration risk capital charge I was mentioning before, APS 112, capital adequacy is a standardised approach to credit risk, and APS 113, capital adequacy internal ratings-based approaches to credit risk. So the latter two standards are for banks and the first standards for general insurers, but they're all covering credit risk. We must also consider issues for downturn scenarios, such as the general insurance requirement for LMIs to use a 1 in 250 year loss scenario to calculate the MER. The overall general insurance MCR intended to cover a 1 in 200 year loss event, and the requirement under Basel II for a bank to use a 1 in 2000 year credit downturn to calculate maximum expected losses. Although APRA have suggested that LMIs will initially not be eligible to apply the internal models approach to capital calculations, this leads to inconsistencies in applying internal models for bank capital but not for insurance capital. The next slide demonstrates some of the possible inconsistencies between when you add the two together. This slide I want to mention up front is just illustrative and it's not to scale, and especially the bars on the right could go up or down, but we're just trying to illustrate how when you add the capital together for the different under the different regulations, you might not necessarily get a consistent picture. The first bar shows Basel I with no LMI, and that capital requirement depends only on bank capital requirements. That's the simple scenario. The second bar shows under Basel I, which is applicable to the banks that have not taken the advanced IRB approach and has been applicable to banks for many years until they started changing in the last couple of years. That shows the capital concessions by implementing LMI on certain loans. And if my memory serves me correctly, it was loans, full doc loans above 80% LVR and low doc loans above 60% LVR. Is that correct? Yeah. So those particular loans, if you had LMI, there was a very big capital concession that was granted to the lender. The third bar shows the transition period with captive LMI. The capital requirements are a maximum of Basel II and 90% of Basel I, because as Lucy mentioned before, there is a floor that has been imposed. So that capital cannot drop beneath 90% of what was previously required. So you can see how the capital has been going down slightly with the first three bars. The fourth bar shows Basel II with captive LMI. The capital requirements after transition, we're surmising, should either be the same as previously or lower, as there's no point in having advanced accreditation status if the Basel II capital is not lower than it was previously. So that's why we've made the fourth bar go down slightly again. And that's still showing the two sets of capital, the LMI capital on the top and the other capital underneath. The fifth bar now, we've either got either five or six. This is kind of looking at the future, and we're not sure how high those bars are going to be. But the prudential capital requirement for Basel II without LMI We're saying they may be higher owing to higher LMI capital requirements or lower owing to no LMI capital concessions. Because if you have no LMI, it means that the bank's own historical statistics on paying out on how much defaults have cost them is going to be higher compared to if they're cushioned by having some LMI. And the sixth bars we're surmising is showing Basel II with captive using internal models. And here the capital requirements may be lower or higher depending upon how the interaction between the internal models, on the interaction between the internal models and prescribed requirements, and whether you're allowed to use internal models for the LMI part of the business or not. So we're really here in this graph just trying to show how if you start to add capital together from institutions that are regulated under different parts of APRA, how you might get some inconsistencies and the capital might go up or down depending upon how those two interact. So we now have time for, I think, about 10 minutes of questions and discussion, but what I might do is I might switch back to the previous slide because that's really what we're really interested in some of your views on. Thank you.
I've got a roaming mic here if we have some questions. Anyone from the floor want to start things off? Well, maybe I'll pose a question. it seems that the history of the LMI market has been one where banks have actually taken the opportunity to actually have an insurance product. So could you maybe summarise why they would move to a Basel II arrangement and keep it within the bank?
Just the first part of the question, which is the banks choosing to provide an insurance product, they absolutely have chosen to do that. But it has been at cost to them because they need to comply with all the regulatory capital requirements of APRA and the regulatory requirements around general insurers, which if they didn't offer that product, they would only have to comply with all the bank requirements. So certainly it is extra effort for them to have to comply with both its requirements. Under Basel II, the banks could choose to still have LMI insurers or not. Your question is, why would they choose?
What's their current benefit from the insurance product to?
The benefit, so I guess one potential benefit for the banks is moving from an insurance product to a non-insurance product is that they wouldn't have to comply with all the regulatory requirements of APRA and the capital requirements. And, of course, in today's world, capital now is far more precious than it used to be 12 or 24 months ago. So that's one of the advantages of not offering the general insurance product. The other potential advantage that I can see is that if you really do want a loan to have LMI insurance, moving it off to a third party rather than keeping the risk within the same group has got to be another advantage.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that we've historically seen captive LMIs is that the business has been profitable, and there has been a wish by some of the banks to actually keep that profit within the group. Certainly in more uncertain times in a changing environment, with potentially loss ratios increasing and that business not being so profitable, again, in the long term, whether that imperative is still there or not remains to be seen.
Thank you very much indeed. I always think it's great when we see presentations around cross practices areas covering sort of banking and GI, for example. And something, Lucy, something that you said that you picked up on, you were talking about the probability of default, and you said that in loan insurance you tended to look at it right through to ultimate, I think was the word that you were using, whereas the banking, as I'm coming to realise, look at a comparatively shorter run model of perhaps 1 year ahead. And I'm guessing, and I wondered, from what you've done in looking at this, have you ever come to a view that there would be merit in helping the banks think about a slightly longer time horizon in the way they deal with capital? And I realise that's separate from Basel II requirements and perhaps thinking about the possibility of economic capital for that.
Yeah, that was exactly the response, actually. I've worked with a number of banks who have helped them to implement, particularly in Europe, where the implementation of Basel II started a few years ago. We've actually helped some of the banks to implement their But often, because the intention of Basel II is to increase the bank's awareness of risk management and just to handle and understand the risks better, this quite often does feed directly into your economic capital model. So whereas the Basel II minimum capital requirement calculation is just over that 1 year of time horizon, you do typically see it feeding into economic capital modelling over a much longer period.
Just to clarify something, if you have two banks with exactly the same mortgage portfolio, Bank A chooses to have a captive LMI, so it's got capital in the LMI, it's got capital back in the portfolio, that's the total amount of capital. Bank B chooses to use an external LMI, so the only capital it's holding there is against the portfolio. Which of those banks, A or B, will have the high? Will be using the greatest amount of capital?
That's a good question, and it does depend on whether the banks are under Basel I or Basel II. But understanding is under Basel I approaches, the bank that externally bought the LMI would have.
Does that one work? Okay. Firstly, the question, it does depend on whether the banks are using the advanced IRB Basel II approach or the Basel I approach. But if we just say, for argument's sake, that both banks are using the Basel I approach, the bank that is externally purchasing the LMI insurance should have lower capital requirements than the bank that is really selling the LMI insurance to its own captive in the group. So I presume you're talking about from a group point of view rather than the... So from a group point of view, if the LMI is within the group, it would have to be capitalised, the bank would have to be capitalised. Arguably, if the banks have got the same mortgage portfolios, their experience will be the same, so the amount of capital that they have to hold to support the risks will be the same. But the bank that's also owning the LMI insurer would have to capitalise that LMI insurer and have higher capital requirements for the overall group. However, because under Basel I they get capital offsets, it has been worthwhile for banks to do that because they get such a big capital offset because of buying LMI insurance. And as Lucy was explaining, it's been very profitable in the last 5 years up to 12 months ago. It has been a very profitable business stream and the banks have wanted to be part of that.
Lucy, have you got?
Yeah, I think this is exactly one of the points that we're actually trying to make, is that there are inconsistencies between the way that bank capital is calculated and GI capital. And I don't think we can definitively say which of the two companies would actually have the higher capital requirement until we see the system fully implemented. It could be a different picture during the transition period to what we see post full implementation of Basel II as well. And this is exactly one of the points that we're trying to highlight, is that you could actually see inconsistencies, because theoretically you would like to see for those risks the same capital within the banking general insurance financial system for those risks, whichever approach was taken.
Yes, but one of the fundamental considerations for LMI was a diversification. So it doesn't work for capital.
No.
LMI is taking external funds.
Yeah.
And that's really important going forward, as the economic environment's more uncertain, deciding what risks to keep on the portfolio and what risks to transfer to a reliable third party is a really important decision.
Yeah.
Questions? No? Well, if there's no more questions, if you could put your hands together for your appreciation for...